This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Music inspired Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon's new book. It's called Telegraph Avenue. The music is from the early 70s. It's called Jazz Funk, and it sounds like this. There you have it, Super Strut, a pretty good example of jazz funk. Telegraph Avenue isn't about people who make that music, though. It's about people who obsess over it, who listen to it as if their lives depended on listening to it. It's set in 2004 in Oakland, California. The book pits record store owners Archie Stallings, who is black, and Nat Jaffe, who is Jewish, against Gibson Good, former NFL star turned mogul, who plans to build a media megastore that includes a department of vintage vinyl recordings of jazz, funk, blues, and soul. It's exactly the music that Archie and Nat sell at their pop and pop shop, Brokeland Records. Michael Chabon has dug into this David and Goliath dynamic before in, frankly, nearly every one of his novels, from The Mysteries of Pittsburgh through to The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Michael Chabon's going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music on October 1st. He is on the program right now, though. Michael Chabon, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. It's great to be back. Thank you.
Let's start with jazz funk. Where did you first hear it? Is that really music you love?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's the kind of thing, it's like the guy in Molière's Bourgeois Gentleman where, you know, he finds out he's been speaking prose all his life without knowing it. I didn't know there really was a whole world of soul jazz and jazz funk, but when I began to explore it, I quickly discovered there was a lot of music I'd been hearing my whole life. In fact, it was kind of the soundtrack, literally, of the early 70s, and on television programs and movies, composers like Lalo Schifrin and so on frequently worked in this idiom. So, you know, I knew it without knowing that that was something actually to be known, but I didn't really know that much about it. It was in the course of researching and writing the book that I discovered this whole world. Actually, now that I think about it, it was through a magazine called Wax Poetics, which is published in Brooklyn Quarterly, which I bought at Quail Ridge Books when I was through town last time on my last book tour. And that's when I discovered that magazine, and through that magazine discovered this whole world of jazz funk.
And that is the beauty of your independent bookstore.
That is truly the case.
There you go. Which is an important part, I think, of in the themes, the many themes that run through this novel, this tension between the indie store and the mega box store. So tell us a little bit about that, because what's beautiful about the book is that it doesn't just set up the fault line right there. It's a much more complicated network of little fault lines that run through these.
Yes, absolutely. The big box store, the superstore that is coming in, it's not, by no means is it a clear case of some big evil corporate retailer, coming in and just deliberately trying to wipe out the competition. Gibson Good, the retired NFL quarterback who is behind this scheme, has already built one of these down in the LA area, and his intention is to try to restore commercial vitality to parts of cities that were harmed by urban renewal of the 60s and 70s and freeway construction. And, the stores themselves specialize in African-American culture, and they're going to be employing a lot of local people. So to oppose this thing, actually the question of whether or not to oppose it is ultimately what starts to divide Archie and Nat, because from Nat's point of view, the white guy, it's just bad, it's going to kill them. But from Archie's point of view, while he acknowledges the truth in that, he also has this real ambivalence about it, because it's also undeniably going to be a good thing for the community.
So tell us about this relationship between Archie and Nat.
They are old friends. You know, they've been friends for more than a decade when we first meet them. They met through music. They play in a band together. The Wakanda Philharmonic is the name of their little combo, and that's how they met. They met when Archie was just back from the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in the early 90s, and he filled in at the last minute as a bass player for this wedding, and the group he was filling in with was Nat's group, and that's how they met, and they, you know, became friends and eventually business partners, and they know each other very well. You know, they love each other. They understand each other. They're also a little bit irritated with each other pretty much on a daily basis, and, you know, they know each other's weaknesses all too well, in addition to, of course, loving one another for each other's strength. So
these characters are certainly unique, and they're unique in this novel, and yet it seems to me that the idea of partners and adversaries being in the same characters is something that's endlessly interesting to you. It's come up before.
Yes, I mean, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is a, sort of a different version of this same kind of story, I guess. I mean, I'm fascinated by the ways in which men form relationships to each other, form attachments and friendships and partnerships, whether they're business partnerships or creative partnerships. And then, of course, you know, I'm telling a story here, so I can't just show that and be content. Those things have to be put to the test. And it's in a way that those relationships are put to the test that, you know, I guess I find a reliable source of story.
Tell us about their business, Brokeland Records. Is that based on a real place?
Well, the inspiration certainly did come from a real place. Another independent retailer. It was a record store on Claremont Avenue in Oakland, California that, alas, isn't there anymore. It was called Berrigan's Records. And one day in about 1999, I walked in there, and I had never been in the store before, and on the day that I happened to walk in there, there were two guys working. One was a black guy, one was a white guy, and there were a bunch of guys hanging around, quote-unquote customers, but nobody was really spending any money or buying anything. They were just all standing around talking.
Well, that's that's the beauty of record stores, but go ahead.
Yes, and I was just struck, you know, immediately by the sense that in this tiny little store, the people had somehow managed to create a kind of a, you know, a bubble in a way in which all the differences between them of race and class and background and everything didn't mean anything. And the only thing that meant anything was that they all loved music and records. And at that instant, I was very forcibly reminded of the place I grew up, which was Columbia, Maryland. A planned community that was built in the 60s and 70s in the suburbs, in the countryside between Baltimore and Washington. And that place, Columbia, from the beginning, at its beginning, was conceived with a kind of vision of racial harmony, of integrated housing and ecumenical places of worship. And I was a boy there, and I really believed in Columbia and the vision of Columbia. And I did grow up around black people. I mean, lots of my classmates and friends and antagonists and, you know, girlfriends and teachers and vice principals and doctors and everybody in my world, you know, there was a large component of black people, and it just seemed like the civil rights movement had been a total success, and the proof of it was the place I was living. And, you know, that's how I grew up. I know, of course, as soon as I left to go to college in Pittsburgh, I immediately, you know, with the force of someone falling off a bicycle and hitting their head on the cement with no helmet, came up against the truth, which was that racism was very much alive and well, and things weren't really like Columbia outside of Columbia.
We're not in Columbia anymore, Toto.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, I still believe such places are possible. I certainly still believe in that vision and that dream, and you know, I felt that when I walked into that record store. I felt it when I heard Barack Obama making his famous keynote address in 2004 at the Democratic Convention. That was the place he was describing, was the place that I had grown up, at least in my imagination. And, you know, in a way, I think it all goes back in literature, certainly in American literature, to Huck and Jim on the raft. I mean, that raft, that's the space I'm talking about, is the space that Mark Twain created.
Well, did you have that in mind when you created Archie and Nat? They could certainly be two guys very much like Huck and Jim on that raft.
Yes, well, sure, of course. I mean, I studied literature in college, and it's impossible for anybody who knows and loves American literature, especially somebody that knows it and loves it as intensely as I do, to start to write about a black guy and a white guy, mm-hmm. And their complicated but ultimately, you know, loving relationship and not think of Huck and Jim.
You explore also these borderlands, their relationship. You place Brokeland Records in a kind of borderland between Berkeley and Oakland. Tell us what that does for you and sort of what it does in the novel.
Well, I mean, crossroads have always been magical places, going back to the beginning of human society. And those are the places where people from different backgrounds, different parts of the world come together. And, that's where you're going to put a caravansary or an inn or a hotel or whatever it might be, or build a tavern. And in a way, Brokeland Records is kind of a non-alcoholic tavern, a non-alcoholic tavern of the soul, I think one of the characters thinks of it as. And, it's a place where, no matter who you are, where you come from, if you love jazz, if you love vinyl, you are welcome. And you don't even have to spend any money. You can just stand around at the counter and get into an argument about Ornette Coleman.
So Telegraph Avenue is set in the year 2004. It's not like there's a hit comedy series about the nostalgia of 2004s.
Not yet. That's coming, though.
I'm sure it is.
I needed to set this book at a time when the threat of a huge brick-and-mortar media retailer would still seem terrifying, which meant I needed to set it before Tower Records went belly up and Virgin Megastores went belly up and all the other big media chains, were driven to extinction by the rise of online streaming and downloading of all kinds of media. And it seemed to me that just about the last moment when that would still have seemed frightening was sometime around 2004. So that determined my choice of time period. And what I got from that as soon as I made that choice, a lot of other possibilities opened up to me. One of them was just a simple dramatic irony that the reader and the writer are both aware of something that Gibson Good, the mogul, doesn't know, which is that as he's going in about the business of stomping on Brokeland Records, he himself is about to get stomped on, and he doesn't even know it. So, I enjoyed that irony, and then it let me set that. It's easier for me, I find, to try to write with a little bit of distance in time. And I have a feeling that about 7 or 8 years is probably like the sort of the minimum amount of distance I need just to be able to get that perspective and be able to see things for how they actually were. And I'm not very good at all at sort of giving a progress report or sort of a status quo update. That's really not my thing.
So Telegraph Avenue has been called one of your most cinematic books. I've seen that in some reviews. Do you agree with that? And if so, why do you think that is? Or why do you think the reviewers are saying it, even if you don't think
sometimes it's hard to know what people mean when they refer to writing as cinematic. Because, of course, I think in part what people mean is that they can really see what they're reading in their minds and in their imagination, and it is quote-unquote like they're watching a movie. That's what people often say, something like that to me. But of course, that effect is produced entirely through the use of words, of ink on paper or pixels on a screen, and there's nothing cinematic about it at all. In fact, it's almost the opposite. But I think in the case of this book, I might agree to that description for certain passages. In particular, one passage in which I very consciously was inspired by the cinematic technique of the tracking shot, the kind of thing that opens a movie like Touch of Evil that you find frequently in the work of Kubrick, and Scorsese uses tracking shots a lot, where it's just one long extended shot that's filmed without a cut, and frequently, like, say, if you think of a movie like Goodfellas, the camera is just moving constantly downstairs, through a doorway, up another set of stairs, into a room, past a whole bunch of people, up onto the stage, if you remember that scene where they're setting up a table for Ray Liotta in that film. And the third section of my book is a kind of tracking shot. It is a single 4,000-word sentence, in other words, one long shot without any cuts, that follows all of the principal characters of the novel and sort of checks in on all of them and sees where they all are as sort of an update at the center of the book before we proceed onward to the ending. And in that case, I really was just directly inspired by cinema.
Is this book has been optioned for film?
Actually, yeah, for television.
A series or?
Yeah, at HBO.
Do writers these days in general, do you, Michael Chabon in particular, do you think about that when you sit down to write a novel? You think this could be a movie?
No, not at all. No, I mean, it's, I guess it's been the case with almost all my books for a while now that they've been optioned before I even write them. Because the producer, Scott Rudin, who has the option on this material and had it on Cavalier and Clay and Yiddish Policeman's Union and Wonder Boy, so it's been a long time, and he always sort of steps in right as I'm beginning, before I've ever actually started, and options the film rights, which has a paradoxical effect of completely relieving me from any obligation of thinking of it as a movie, because he stuck with it.
Yeah.
No matter what, even if I'm just, you know, transcribing the yellow pages, he has the option on that, and I don't need to worry about whether it would make a good movie at all.
Actually, I've seen that on FX, the yellow pages. Michael, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Oh, for me too. Thank you, Frank.
Michael Chabon's new novel is called Telegraph Avenue. He reads at your independent bookstore, Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh, on October 1st at 7:30. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. Find us at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Nguyen. Robin Copley is the technical director, managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.